Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
She's never been obsessed before. This is her first time, and it's kind of interesting. It's like watching some psychopath in a movie stalking someone, plotting to kill them, except that the psychopath is her. In Canada, it's not so bad. She can't call Jake from Toronto because he'd see the area code and guess it was her. So it's only in his country, where she'll be in 90 minutes, that it happens. There, she won't be able to walk by a payphone without having to wrestle down the desire to do again what she's already done numerous times. Dial his number and then keep silent on the end of the line. An ominous, threatening silence. This is G.P. Gottlieb, author of the Whipped and Sipped Mystery Series and host for New Books in Literature, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Today I'm talking to Nora Gold, author of The Dead Man, the story of a Canadian composer and music therapist who's obsessed with a man with whom she had an affair over 5 years before. She travels back to Jerusalem where the affair began with hopes of both ending her obsession and finishing the song cycle she'd written about the famous but married and possibly psychopathic music critic. There she revisits their moments together while at the same time allowing long-forgotten childhood truths to emerge. She allows the sounds around her to penetrate the barriers she had erected over the years, and in doing so, finally hears the music to end both her composition and her obsession. Hi, Nora. Thanks for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me, Galit.
So your book was published in 2016, so I'm not sure why I waited so long to interview you about a book that's so close to what I love, specifically music. How did you come to write The Dead Man, and why did you organize it in a recognizable musical form?
Well, I came to write the novel actually through stumbling across an old movie called Play Misty For Me. And I was fascinated by the whole theme of obsession. It's about a woman who stalks a DJ that she's in love with. And I thought it was ridiculous, but somehow it lodged in my brain as something fascinating, especially the idea of a woman stalking a man and thinking that she couldn't live without him, which was very foreign to me. So I became interested in the whole concept of obsession. I started to notice many people around me were obsessed with one thing or another, which I had never noticed before. And I thought it was fascinating, this difference between what someone can know intellectually and then what emotionally they can seize onto in a very irrational way. So that was how it started. I decided to give it a structure, a musical structure, because I love music. And one of my favorite forms is the sonata. So the novel is structured the same way as a sonata, which includes the theme, the exposition, development, and recapitulation, and also a coda. And for me, it was actually a bit of a metaphor for life and for the main character, because, you know, in life, you start off with something, your exposition, and you develop. And then in a way, you come back. You don't come back ever to exactly the same place, but you sort of circle back in a spiral to some things that you started out with. And I think that is what happens to the character in this book. She returns to something very basic that she began with, although as in life, she actually returns to a different place. And finally, in a sonata, you can have a coda, a concluding passage, a kind of PS. And in this novel, the coda is 2 pages long. And without giving anything away, on the very last page, Eve actually hears music in something she's never heard music in before, which in a way sums up this massive transformation she goes through in the course of the book.
I really loved the character of Eve and how she hears music and everything. But first, how and why did you choose the title, The Dead Man?
Well, the title was always with me, actually. I always felt that was the title for this novel. One of the questions I'm most often asked, actually, is in relation to the title, who is the dead man in this novel? And the answer, actually, is that it's a little ambiguous because there's more than one man in this book, even though not all of them are physically dead. And in a way, perhaps that's one of the sub-themes of this novel. You know, what is it to be truly alive and what is it to be physically alive, but in any real sense to be dead emotionally or spiritually? What is it to be dead? So I think the deadness in the title captures and resonates with this whole interest in human aliveness and people who are internally not alive, but actually dead.
Mm. What does it mean when, in describing some of her therapy research, Eve says that she experienced stories of borderline personality as songs instead of case studies?
Well, you know, Eve, like a lot of people, Eve lives in more than one world. She lives in both in the worlds of psychology and art. And there are places and times in this book where the lines blur between these worlds. So as a therapist, as a music therapist, Eve is listening to people tell their life stories. And she knows she's supposed to be viewing these stories through the lenses of a therapist, or listening to them through the headphones, maybe, you know, in terms of psychological concepts like dissociation and splitting and so forth. But in fact, what she hears is the music in their souls, which is sad music or frightened music or whatever, because that's the language that she understands the best. So if for instance, if she weren't a composer, if she were a visual artist, she'd be listening to these people and picturing them in terms of how she could paint them. So I see this kind of blurring as a way in which she crosses realities and her inner languages mixed together.
Mm-hmm. One of the book's themes has to do with bird songs, which is also the title of a composition that Eve needs to finish in order to enter it into a competition, which sort of drives some of the action. What is it that drew you in about bird songs?
Well, I love music and I love nature. And I guess birdsong is a classic example, really, of music in nature. If you ask people, where do you hear music in nature? People would say, well, birds. As it happens, I do my writing in a little coach house in my backyard. And there are a lot of birds there. I'm not sure why, but dozens and dozens of birds on any day. And a lot of birdsong, of course. And one day I noticed it. And for the first time, I really heard the music. I really recognized it as real music. And I looked it up online. I was fascinated to discover, which maybe other people know, but I didn't know until this point, that every species of bird actually has a completely different set of music, not just one piece of music, but a whole musical language. And I was really struck by that. I was at that point beginning this novel, The Dead Man. And I thought, you know, this is something that Eve might have noticed and reacted to in the same way. So that's how birdsong made it into this novel.
I just loved how she heard the actual exact notes with her perfect pitch. Eve tells us that every few months she sees faces of random people just before she falls asleep. What does that tell us about her?
Well, I think it shows that Eve is a person who feels connected to the world and to humanity very broadly. You know, she's someone who lives very much in her imagination. She has this profoundly imaginative and idealized relationship with this man, Jake. So these people who flash past her face before she falls asleep, she's connected not only in terms of the people she personally knows and faces that she's seen in, quote, real life, but she recognizes she's part of everything that exists and everybody that exists, that as human beings, we're all intertwined, almost in a mystical way, that we're all one, you know? And because she's such an imaginative person, someone who lives in emotional and psychological places that really transcend her immediate physical reality. And because she spends so much of her time and emotional energy in this imaginary relationship with Jake, I mean, this is no longer a real relationship. She also feels connected to humanity at large as she imagines it in all of its diversity, in all of its beauty and complexity. And these people are really a part of her, even though she's never really met any of them in real life.
We learn that she was widowed relatively young and has raised her two sons alone. So why do we learn so little about her husband and the relationship she had with him?
Yeah. Well, you know, this novel is about a lot of things. One of the things that it's definitely about is grief, the nature of grief, the difficulty overcoming grief. In Eve's case, her way of coping with the loss of her husband has been to block him out and block out all her grief about losing him. She was a young woman, as you said, and it was a very great and traumatic loss. So at the time of this novel, which is 10 years after his death, her husband is really not on her mind. He's not really in her mind. I would say, psychically speaking, she has buried him already. And since this novel is told entirely and exclusively from Eve's point of view, you know, by definition, the reader can't know or access anything that Eve doesn't know or access. She has to be conscious of something for the reader to be shown it. So this is why Eve's late husband seems completely or almost completely absent from the novel, when actually, as the reader discovers later on, he's absolutely crucial to the story. And later on in the novel, even though initially, you know, he seems absent, towards the end of the novel, when she isn't quite as blocked as she is at the beginning, and after she's gone through many changes, he appears, and significantly, I would say.
Let's discuss Jake. He's the older married man with whom Eve had an affair, a brief affair, and he continues to haunt her over five years later. At some point, she realizes that her memories of him were like flashbacks after PTSD. So why can't she forget him and move on?
Well, this is the million-dollar question, really, at the heart of this novel. I mean, what is Eve's obsession really about? Why can't she get over him? You know, this was a relationship not only that ended 5.5 years ago, but the entire duration of the relationship was 5 months. So this was a brief relationship. Eve is a very sensible and sophisticated and down-to-earth sort of person. I mean, not only can she not understand what's happened to her, none of her friends can understand. It makes no sense to anybody. So it's a very, very puzzling and strange sort of fact about her right at the beginning. And without giving any spoilers away, you know, I would say when you ask why can't she forget him and move on, there are some very traumatizing elements in this relationship, which she isn't aware of really until, again, later in the novel. Some of them are because of Jake's characteristics. You know, he's this intelligent and charismatic man, but he's also narcissistic and he's also a psychopath. And there are elements in Eve herself, you know, all sorts of unresolved pieces of her past that she hasn't come to terms with. So there's this mystery. I mean, you really put your finger on the basic mystery at the core of this novel. And this mystery is solved and the secret is revealed at the end of the book.
Yeah. She remembers some of their nice moments, of course, but she also recalls how repulsed she was when she learned things about Jake. Like, he comes right out and says he never liked his second daughter. And then much later, she learns that this unloved daughter suffers from severe anorexia. So right. Let's discuss.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Well, first of all, she's very shocked and very, very upset when she discovers his attitude towards his second daughter. I think part of that is, you know, when we've idealized someone, which is something we've all done at one point or another, it's always a massive shock to discover that this person has clay feet or flaws for the first time. And this is what happens to Eve when Jake reveals that not only does he like only one of his two daughters, he likes the older one, but he doesn't like the younger one, but that actually the younger one disgusts him and that he's very rejecting and very cruel towards her. And, you know, Eve's a mother. She has two boys. She knows you can have complicated feelings towards your children. But Jake's attitude towards this younger daughter shows her in a way that she can't deny. She doesn't want to see it, but she can't help see now that there's a whole side to Jake that is very repulsive and very frightening to her. And she doesn't know if at some point maybe he'll hate her the way he hates this daughter. Now, when it comes to anorexia, you know, she's a therapist. She recognizes that when there's anorexia in a family, it's never just about the presenting young person. Usually it's a child in the family. It tells them you something about the entire family system, certainly about the marital dyad. And even after this, she continues to be involved with Jake. So again, we're touching on that same mystery of, you know, here's this smart woman. She sees that she's dealing with someone who's disturbed and dangerous, and she continues to be involved. I think the reason, and again, this isn't giving away the whole book at all, but in a way, it's perhaps even a bit obvious, but she's in love with him. And I think, you know, we've all been there where your mind says one thing and your heart says the other. You can know that someone is sick and sexist and disgusting in many ways and so forth, but you can't pull away from them because you love them. And you rationalize, you know, human beings are geniuses at self-deception. We make excuses for the people we love, and we even make excuses for things that we love or want to do. You know, if you think about why people keep smoking or overeating or not exercising, you know, you do all sorts of things that are bad for you because your emotions override what you know rationally to be true. It's a kind of denial. And I think that's very much at work in Eve.
Yeah. So Eve is a composer, and she's composed a major piece that Jake could, with his connections and his position, he could help her get it performed. And she hasn't been able to get it performed in Toronto. How much of their relationship is mercenary on her part?
Well, I don't see Eve as fundamentally mercenary or as primarily using Jake, so to speak, to advance her career. Eve is not a schemer. She's someone who's madly and helplessly in love. She adores Jake. She idealizes Jake. But she does look to him with the expectation that almost magically he can transform her in every way. So she's thinking, or she's hoping, that he can emotionally, spiritually, artistically, sexually bring her to life. He'll make her beautiful. He'll make her famous, you know. So the career element is just part of an entire fantasy. And I think, you know, I think many times in life, we think that someone else can make us into what we want to be. It's part of the psychology of falling in love. You know, you think the love object is going to, they're perfect and idealized, and then they'll make us perfect and ideal. And I don't think we only do this when we're 16 years old. I think people do this much later in life, often without realizing what they're doing.
One of Eve's explanations about why she can't forget Jake is that in her family, she learned that you never let go of someone even after death. So how does her composition, and then she creates this composition called The Song of the Mourning Dove. How does it help her end this cycle?
Well, you know, she calls it a love-hate cycle, and it certainly is a very complex kind of relationship. It's not your usual love affair. It's a love-hate affair. I think the whole issue of family beliefs is very interesting. In her family, if you love someone, you never stop loving them. And if you, in her family of origin, we're talking, and if you do move on, so to speak, it means you never loved them. So there's this very tyrannical belief system that only at a certain point in this novel gets challenged to good effect. As for the role that writing this composition played in helping her to recover, I don't think composing this piece necessarily causes the beginning of the end of the obsession as much as it's the expression of it, you know, of the fact that she's already started to let go of this relationship. I think that for an artist, whether it's a musician or a sculptor or a writer, whatever, there's both a cause and effect between the creator and her work. Your creation is shaped by you, but it also shapes you, you know. It reflects that you've taken a step forward, but it also moves you forward a step or two. So I think there's a whole cause and effect of the changes within you that artistic work expresses. And I think that kind of dual role is what this song that she composes does for her. And especially since she's been artistically frozen since she left Jake, she hasn't managed to compose or create anything. So this is a very important breakthrough for her.
Let's discuss a few of the other characters in the novel. So first, Jake's long-suffering wife.
Well, Fran is somebody who Eve feels sorry for, actually. Eve is a feminist, and woman to woman, she feels very guilty about hurting another woman. She thinks of women as her sisters. So it's very complicated. She tries to keep her relationship with Jake separate from his relationship with Fran, but part of Jake's psychological makeup is that he likes to triangulate and play them off each other. So in a sense, this very dysfunctional and problematic relationship with Jake is really part of a three-way triangle that he creates. And that makes it much harder for her to separate herself than it would be.
Yeah. Eve's father, who recently died.
Well, Eve's father is another dead man in this novel. Another man who, in a sense, betrayed Eve by giving in to his wife, Julia. He remarries this woman who wants to get rid of Eve and send her away to boarding school. And her father was a weak man who didn't stand up to this woman. So there are all sorts of parallels between the men in the novel who are lovable and wonderful and at the same time very flawed. And of course, this novel takes place since the father recently died. Very much in a mourning phase for him as well. Mm-hmm.
Okay, and you mentioned Julia, her stepmother. So
yes, who? Yeah, I think you know the main thing about her is that she wanted to get rid of Eve, and she succeeded.
And then Eve's mother.
Well, Eve's mother died when Eve was 3 years old, and she died violently in Eve's presence. So I would say, you know, if you're talking about Eve and Julia and Eve's, you know, Eve's father and Eve's stepmother and Eve's mother, these three adult characters all represent very major losses for Eve. And I would say she hasn't necessarily mourned these losses or, so to speak, resolved these relationships. There are all sorts of troubled and troubling aspects to them in her mind, even all this time later. And I would say that all of these unresolved relationships very much feed into her longing for Jake and her love for Jake and her need for Jake. There's a whole parental and familial piece to this story.
Mm-hmm. So I really enjoyed this book, even though I just don't love stories about people who have affairs with married men. However, she is a feminist, and you have written in this book one of the best descriptions of what a feminist is, or best description of a woman explaining to an old boomer what a feminist is. So where'd you come up with that?
Well, you know, one of the things that Eve is in denial about, once she begins to see Jake as less of an idealized figure and more as a real man, she recognizes that he's profoundly sexist. You know, the two of them coexist in the same world of Jewish sacred music, and he has a terrible reputation as being massively sexist vis-a-vis women composers, within his professional realm. He doesn't take women composers seriously at all. And she thinks that if she explains to him that he's mistaken and introduces him to feminism, you know, he asks her, what is feminism? Tell me about the F word. She can persuade him in 10 minutes and transform him, you know, the whole theme of him transforming her, but she will transform him into a man who is not sexist. Of course, in 10 minutes, you don't succeed in doing that, but she thinks she does. And it's a very important aspect of this novel because there are so many novels and operas and other art forms about women who can't get over a man, you know, the Harlequin romances, for example. And one thing about this novel, which is unusual, is that it looks at that kind of a problem through a feminist lens and critiques it. In some ways, it's an anti-romance, and it shows a very dignified feminist struggling with her feelings, even though she's intellectually completely aware that this is reprehensible in terms of everything she believes.
Right. Well, I think every woman who reads it is rooting for her. So,
well, thank you. I'm glad to hear it.
So, Nora, can you talk a bit about the online literary journal that you founded, and then tell us what you're working on now?
Okay, well, the journal that I founded is called JewishFiction.net. It's a free online literary journal, www.jewishfiction.net. Currently the only English language journal, either in print or online, anywhere in the world that's devoted exclusively to Jewish fiction. And we showcase fine, excellent contemporary writing on Jewish themes from around the world, So far, in our first 10 years, we've published over 400 stories or novel excerpts, originally written in 16 languages, which I'm very excited about, never before published in English, and we have readers in 140 countries. And we've published some very famous writers like Elie Wiesel, Aaron Appelfeld, Tova Mervis, Steve Stern, A.B. Anshua, and so forth, and many very fine writers who aren't yet well known. It's free of charge, and we welcome submissions from writers on Jewish themes. You don't have to be Jewish, obviously, to be writing that sort of fiction. I've just finished a new novel, which is currently being read by my publisher, and I'm just started something brand new, which I'm very excited about. Very different from anything I've written before, and it's too early to really discuss the theme of it, but it's a different structure. It's an unusual structure. I don't know if I was inspired by the sonata form in The Dead Man or what, but it's somewhat more experimental than I'm used to, and I'm curious to see where it's going to go.
Okay. So instead of being Mozart, it's more Bach. Is that what you're saying?
Or Copeland, okay. Or actually 21st century.
Oh, cool. Yeah. I'll look forward to it. Thank you so much for joining me today. This has been a pleasure.
Thank you, Gobi. I've been delighted to be part of it, and thank you so much.
And thank you for joining me. Again, this is G.P. Gottlieb, author of the Whipped and Sipped Mystery Series and host for New Books in Literature, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Today I've been speaking to Nora Gold about her novel, The Dead Man. If you enjoyed today's podcast and would like to discuss it further with me and other New Books Network listeners, please join us on Shuffle. Shuffle is an ad-free, invite-only network focused on the creativity community. As New Book Network listeners, you can get special access to conversations with a dynamic community of writers and literary enthusiasts. Sign up by going to www.shuffle.do/NBN/join.